the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Brooke and I are going to have fun today, and we're going to kick it off with our favorite TV series of all time. And we live in a kind of a golden age of television. There's a lot of options out there, obviously, so we'll look into that. But I think a lot of TV from the past is good, too. We'll also look at talking about Donald Trump and the hypocrisy in the Democratic Party and just all the kerfuffle with our president right now. What's going on? Why are people outraged? Should they be outraged? And then we'll look at moving government agencies out of Raleigh and Washington, D.C. What's the latest on that? And just for a brief moment, we'll address the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon. So, Brooke, how's it going today?
Wow. Well, it's going very toasty.
Yeah, we don't have AC
here. If I might say
here.
So myself. Yeah. So Ray and I are like sweltering here in the radio room, but...
But we are sacrificing for you and
for
plugging
you, our
away.
Audience. Yep. We care about you.
We do. We're
so
plugging away.
Hopefully you're listening to this in a wonderfully air-conditioned environment. If not, maybe you're working out, going on a run, in which case you're probably sweltering if you're here in North Carolina, because we do summer really, really hot around these parts, don't we?
Yeah.
Hot and humid.
Yeah, I don't complain about North Carolina too much because I've lived in Mississippi, I've lived in Egypt, but North Carolina obviously gets hot, but I'm not one to incessantly complain about the heat like some do.
Okay, and then you just cut your eyes over at me. Are you referring to me?
No, I'm just saying, okay. In general. I don't think you're that bad.
No, I'm not. I was just fanning myself, though, earlier because it is a little warm in here, but
yeah.
That's okay. We'll
you had
be
to
right.
go get a fan.
I did. I've got a little area fan in front of me. I didn't even offer to put it in front of Ray.
Nope.
Because he's not complaining, so he's taking it
That's
like
right.
a champ.
I'm just kind of a, you know, I'm a man when it comes to the heat.
And I'm not. When it comes to the heat or the cold, I need it a very perfect 73 degrees year-round.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, having lived in Hawaii where it has perfect weather, I do miss that where every day was essentially perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of miss that. It was never too hot. It obviously was never too cold, and it was just beautiful all the time. You know, you got rain for 15 or 10 minutes at 5:35 every day p.m. But other than that, I mean, the weather was just amazing.
Well, Hawaii's perfect, and obviously Hawaiian people are
That's
perfect.
True. Yeah, they're so perfect.
And as a 1/5 Hawaiian woman, I will claim that 1/5 of me is perfect.
So, Brooke, what is your favorite TV series of all time? I know you collected some data from some of our colleagues.
Yes,
too.
Yes. So, we wanted to help you guys get to know our staff a little bit. So, I asked them, or at least several of them that are in the office right now, what their favorite TV series is.
Don't have high expectations, people. Lower your expectations.
These aren't things that are like really intellectually deep or anything. Just heads up, y'all. Okay. But maybe we'll give you something to watch if you're curious. You're in a Netflix famine or something.
Right.
So Carrie, who is our development and operations manager, said that her current favorite series is Big Little Lies. And her all-time favorite one, though, is Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
I've never seen either of those.
Neither have I, but apparently she loves them.
But I can imagine, like, having appeal, sort of that garbage element of television, something like Real,
garbage element?
Real Housewives of Beverly Hills could be entertaining.
Oh, I think it would. I have seen, like, half of an episode. No, maybe a fourth of an episode of New Jersey Housewives or something like that. But, yeah, I just haven't watched those. But Carrie likes that. Leah, who is our budget and tax analyst, she really likes New Girl. That was hers.
I don't know what that is. But
okay. Well, maybe you've heard this one. Andy, who is our elections policy analyst, says that he really hasn't watched a regular TV show for 2 decades now.
Wow.
But he does watch some stuff with his kids, and that is Ninjago. That's their current favorite.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, I do. So I've got little boys, too. Well, I mean, so do you, Ray, but your little boys aren't old enough to probably watch this.
Probably
but
not.
It's a Lego TV series.
James really likes Daniel...
Daniel the Tiger.
Daniel the Tiger. Right,
yeah, that's a cute one.
It is cute.
And it teaches, I think you were saying it
teaches
like
some values.
Yeah,
it's based off of the set from Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
And so Daniel the Tiger was one of the characters, which I remember actually when I was little, I was very into Mr. Rogers and did not like Sesame Street. So I've always had a soft spot for Fred Rogers. And it's just interesting that it does teach a very good moral lessons throughout the episode. It's about sharing and
which is something that 2-year-olds need to learn.
Yeah, just stuff. And you can see like the little wheels turning when they watch it. They realize they're being convicted a little bit of some of the stuff that they do.
Thank God for shows like that, because it doesn't seem like we have enough of those out there.
We need more of that.
So Reagan, who is our summer intern, her favorite is Scorpion. So she said it's kind of like a drama, but it's a little cheesy, she said, but still the storyline's really good. So those are some of our staffers, and I will go ahead and let you say yours, and then I'll share mine.
Well, I've got so many, but this is going to be for the older listeners. This is going to be it may cause them to smile a little bit, but it also may cause them to be a little bit concerned. But in college, I do remember this when I was a kid because I knew it was time to go to bed when I heard this theme song. But in college, I really got hooked on Dallas.
Wow, that's like a blast from the past.
I bet very late 70s, early 80s, all the way up. I think it maybe went up to 87, 88,
like
89.
Like my grandma liked that show.
Dallas, J.R. Ewing was kind of even though he was a morally suspect, not even suspect, just a morally bankrupt kind of person. He was kind of a hero to me, the way he just sort of like, you know,
kind of a hero to you, even though he was morally bankrupt and like a horrible person. He was
completely
totally a hero.
I don't know. It's just like he wanted to see what JR was going to do next, you know.
But you called him a hero. That's
but you know
weird.
What I mean.
No, I don't. please go ahead and dig yourself out of that hole, right?
Just you wanted to see what you, in a way, you couldn't help but rooting for JR's evil conniving.
Because you wanted the juiciness of the show.
Yeah. So maybe I'm just as bad as Carrie.
Yeah. Here you are judging Carrie for her Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
So I always like Dallas. I guess as a comedy, I've always liked Cheers a lot.
That's a good one. It's been a long time since
I've
seen that.
Yeah, so I was much more into Kirstie Alley, though, than Diane, which was Shelley Long. I wasn't a big Shelley Long fan. I think Kirstie Alley fit that show a lot better. But there's other shows. I got more recent. The Chernobyl series on HBO was brilliant. I've always liked Band of Brothers, but I've had a little problem with some of the accuracy, just some minor stuff that they – Stephen Ambrose later in life was not great at research and accuracy all the time, but he's a good historian. And then, of course, Mad Men had some appeal to me, and there are others. Friday Night Lights had a little bit of appeal. But I can't watch more than 2 seasons of something nowadays. I just kind of lose interest.
Yeah.
What about you, Brooke?
So Mad Men was one as well that I liked. I mean, definitely not one you would watch with the children around. And I did do quite a bit of fast forwarding, but the storyline itself, when it came to a marketing agency and then the main antagonist just struggling with who he was as a person and watching him develop as a person and character and seeing his rise and fall.
He was a bad dude too in many ways.
Yeah, he was. He was probably like a JR.
I think JR was worse.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was interesting though, just to see how there was a lesson in that. You reap what you sow, and he would sow really, really bad choices, and he would reap it, and they wouldn't romanticize it at all. They would really show you the rawness of poor decision making. So anyways, that was good. And then, all of all time, 24. Kiefer Sutherland, Jack Bauer, oh my goodness. He can save everything and everybody. He is like the Chuck Norris of my generation. So
yeah,
I like Kiefer Sutherland.
Speaking of Larry Hagman on Dallas, he's the guy that played J.R. Ewing. Very good actor. Died a few years back. But he was also I Dream of Jeannie. That was a good show.
Oh, that was a good show.
Barbara
she
Eden.
Had her little
he
cute
was a much
nose
different
twitch.
Character, obviously, in I Dream of Jeannie. But yeah, I mean,
that was Bewitched.
Who
I'm
wouldn't want
Bewitched.
Like a little genie slave, you know?
Who wouldn't want a genie slave?
Of course, it didn't work out. She ended up in some ways being a little bit more trouble than maybe she was worth. But that was a good
but
show.
But that was a fun show.
That's
I remember
throwback,
watching that,
you know, retro.
In the Dick Van Dyke Show. I loved that
some
show.
Great. I always liked Andy Griffith. I liked Leave It to Beaver. I mean, I don't think anybody watches Leave It to Beaver anymore. But a few years back, I watched some of the episodes. And you know what's so interesting, Brooke, is like, not only the moral lessons, but the whole wholesomeness of the show.
Yeah.
It's like you watch and it's very bizarre to watch. And I know that obviously in the 1950s there was a lot of nefarious stuff going on. You had film noirs, and there was a lot of crime and a lot of different things that we overlook today because it sometimes seems as this like period of great family values and the nuclear family and very pro America because of the Cold War. But you watch the show and it's just the values coming out of Hollywood are strikingly different than today. I mean, it's so interesting, and roles of sexes and things like that are very defined.
I long for those days again, and I'm not one to romanticize the past.
No.
There were you and I both know there were plenty of issues, but on the other hand, we shouldn't romanticize the present either. And
no.
There's a lot of ways in which we need to evolve, for lack of a better term, or become better. And actually, that is a good segue into some of the political stuff we're going to cover on today's podcast, namely the whole Twitter back and forth, and not just Twitter, but the back and forth between the president and Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Party, and just everything that's been the squad, which is Tlaib, Omar, Ocasio-Cortez,
and who's the other one? She's the one that said F Trump, I think, during the...
Wasn't that Tlaib?
Oh, maybe that was Tlaib.
So, anyways, okay, we'll find out who the other fourth person is. But what we've seen is just such so much mudslinging in our political discourse. But really, who's to blame in that? Is it just one party? Is it just politicians? Is it the culture at large? Is it us? And so I think that's something we need to have some self-reflection. Ray and I were talking about this earlier, just the importance of culture and all of this and how politics is downstream from culture. And so if politics is downstream from culture, you know, whatever you think of the current political theater going on, really we need to look inward and see what we're promoting or tolerating that is creating the conditions for this.
Ayanna Pressley
from
Massachusetts. And, of course, like you mentioned, Omar, Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib.
Yeah. So, anyways, there's been this Twitter spat back and forth. The president recently had told these four that they need to go back to the countries they came from if they don't like America. And a lot of people accused him of making a racist statement. I think that what he said was deplorable, namely that three of these people were even born in the United States and they are American citizens, whether you agree with their politics or not. But on the other hand, the Democratic Party, some of their leaders have been quite racist in some of their remarks. And so it seems like there's a lot of hypocrisy and finger pointing going on. And we're not really dealing with some of these harder issues. We're just lobbing the label of racist.
Trump
over
has
everything.
So many tweets. I'm trying to dig up the tweets. And I can't find them because he's retweeted so many people.
I think I can find it. I've already got an article pulled up from USA Today.
I think the big question, Brooke, is do you think that they're racist tweets? Because I'm having trouble with that sort of verbiage or usage.
Well, and I think that's a valid question given that the label racist is used so flippantly nowadays that it sort of takes away the severity of the meaning that the word should carry. On the other hand, because there are some, having dealt with racism and seen it firsthand and seen my kids experience it, I think that even if those tweets that he issued weren't necessarily racist, I think it stokes the flames of those that are more that way. It's almost creating better, more favorable conditions for those sort of people
operate. I think that's fair. I mean,
so even if so this is what the tweet said. So interesting to see progressive Democrat congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, if they even have a functioning government at all, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? Then they can come back and show us how. It is done.
I don't find anything racist in the tweet itself.
I think more than anything, it is nationalist in a way that excludes those that are American citizens that disagree with him. Because what about during the Obama years?
Do you not think he's specifically talking about a few members of Congress here?
So, yeah, who are from the United States, and he's telling them to go back.
I totally understand. I understand like the error that he made and sort of the context. But I think that I wonder. You know what Trump reminds me of? He reminds me of that construction worker in Queens who kind of just yells stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he comes from New York where people speak their mind, and they're not necessarily cultured in a way that, you know, for the sort of intellectual or academic crowd. And so he just speaks his mind without a filter. I mean, that's what Trump's famous for, obviously. And he says these things that a lot of people are thinking. But this sort of terminology, we see this to celebrities all the time, or just people in our culture. Oh, if you don't like it, leave it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or go back to your home country, or go back to your country if you hate America so much. So to me, that's what he's extrapolating. Now, you mm-hmm. can argue that that's insensitive. You can argue that that is not sort of the sort of symbolic open arms that we've had for immigrants of all nations, of all over the world, that America has really become. I mean, this is really the nation. Ronald Reagan explained it so well. This is America's really the only place that you can come here, whether you're a Vietnamese boat person or Japanese or German, and become an American. You can't mm-hmm. go to those countries and become essentially Vietnamese or Japanese, especially in Japan. They don't allow that or accept that. You'll never be Japanese
mm-hmm.
Or even German. You're not going to be considered German per se just because you would go there or even become a citizen. So America's very unique in that way. And so I think Trump's just kind of speaking what a lot of people are thinking. And I don't know if that's necessarily the right language for the president. In many ways, it's wrong, the way that he sort of like picks these fights. I'm not convinced that he'll be hurt politically by it, though.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So either. I don't know. I'm kind of struggling with like everyone screaming that it's racist, and I'm having a hard time with that.
Yeah, well, and I think there are some others that feel the same way as you. I'm a little less, I guess, gracious when it comes to him saying stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think that it's just really, really distasteful. And I believe it stokes other flames where there are people that are very racist and they kind of latch onto this. And that's their choice. He can't determine how people are going to weaponize his words.
Yeah, it's certainly not presidential. But I don't want anybody to think that that's what I'm saying.
Right, but he's giving them fodder needlessly. And so I think that that's irresponsible as the leader of all Americans, including immigrants or those with whom you disagree politically. But like Brit Hume, for example, on Fox News, he said, you know, the comments were insensitive. They were unbecoming of a president,
yeah.
But they don't rise to the level of racism.
Yeah, I think I'd agree more with Hume.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just is a more traditional understanding of probably his verbiage and language that he used. Because to me, it's not racist. It's not even racist to point out that there's some really crappy countries out there. I mean, having been all over the world, I've seen some pretty
systems of government.
But you know, we have a lot of problems in America. So I'm not one of these people that walks around and says America's superior in every way to every other country.
But I think it is superior in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, but not in every way.
Correct. Well, and that's the thing. So I was actually on a radio program the other day, and we were talking about this. You know, is America the greatest?
Mm.
And I'd say in terms of helping people, lift people out of poverty, giving equal treatment under the law, and providing the conditions for free enterprise, we do really, really well.
Oh, absolutely.
When it comes to civil liberties,
yeah.
Being a melting pot, we're able to still function as a republic. So those are some laudable things. And yet, even still, I can also acknowledge that America really has failed in a lot of ways. I mean, we had chattel slavery for decades and mistreated those people of color that were Americans by either birth or forced here by slavery, and just mistreated them. We denied women the right to vote, and we continue to abort many, many children.
Yeah, over 60 something million at least.
And we turn a blind eye to that. So America still has to grow in those areas or repent and turn away from what we've been doing. And yet still there are areas in which we can praise America exceptionalism.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest. I'm just going to throw it out here. I know this is controversial probably to say, but I'm not as patriotic in some senses as I was growing up in this country, just because I think culturally there's a lot of dysfunction in America. There's not a unified nation anymore. We're now in a place, I think, where anything goes, for a lack of a better word, when it comes to maybe just cultural norms. So, you know, I still love this country. I still love America, still love our flag and all those things. But there's a little bit that has left me. And I think some of this came after the Obergefell Hodges ruling to some degree, when you saw these sort of, you know, how people that just that, you know, thought that a marriage is between a man and a woman and what that meant. Now that those people were going to be considered bigots, I think, by the larger culture. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've become a little bit more standoffish when it just becomes this sort of like epic praise of everything American.
Yeah. The culture, the lines between cultural norms of times past and our present postmodernism is really, really marked. And really, that's where a lot of these fault lines that we see in Washington, they started in the culture at large, when it comes to marriage, when it comes to right to life issues, when it comes to gender identity. I mean, things that really get to the heart of who we are as individuals. Right. And so if you're looking at this through a culture war lens, you know, look at that first. Really look at the nuclear family. Look at how we look at other people, how we see them as individuals, made in the image of God. Like, these are things that really get to the heart of where our divisions lie.
Yeah, I think if you are a conservative who is never Trump, or someone who's just angry at Trump, and if you're not looking at the culture first, because really, whatever you feel about Trump, Trump is a creation of our culture. He's a performer. He's a very effective leader in some ways, but he's primarily a performer. Anybody who's seen him in a live atmosphere, which I saw him up at CPAC, he's a great showman, and that's what he does. And I think he's sort of this outgrowth of our reality-based entertainment culture, and in many ways our kind of pseudo intellectual leadership culture to some degree. He's very gruff. He's very tell it like it is. But I think if you're somebody who's conservative and you think that this nation can be healed by just interchanging some kind of leader, I think you're completely bankrupt, because Trump really is a creation of our culture. And that's not to demean everything about Trump, because I think there's some very positive Trumps. I think Trump in many ways is sort of holding up this last vestige of some good ideals in middle America that would be completely overrun from a political perspective by people out there who do want to destroy this nation. And that's why, you know, when we started this, Brooke, we wanted to talk a little bit about the hypocrisy. And I think that's something that's been missing in this whole debate, is that some of these people that Trump has called out have been very anti-American in some of their language that they've mm-hmm. used. They've certainly demeaned white Americans in ways.
Yeah.
And I think to be careful here, because Trump's obviously president of everybody, but I don't like the word dog whistle, because I don't necessarily see it as a dog whistle as some people are describing it. I think what Trump is honestly doing, and what he thinks he's doing, is sticking up for a segment of America that feels like they're being trampled. That doesn't mean that's true, that they're being trampled. I'm not saying that, but there's a segment out there that do think that they're kind of being marginalized and pushed to the side.
Can I ask you something on that front? Because, okay, we talked last week, we touched on his Forgotten Man speech, and that really, I think, captured what you're saying right there. He calls them the Forgotten Man. But do you think part of the reason some of that middle America, and I have family in middle America, my uncle's a soybean farmer, has been for generations. Like, my mom's from Iowa. But some of these ideals that we're holding on to, that we associate with the Forgotten Man, is really we as Americans have failed to failed to evolve economically, where we're still longing for these days of manufacturing.
I get you, yeah.
And like, we want Detroit again,
right,
and things like that. And really, we need to look at how things are in the present.
No, you got to live in the reality, right? You got to compare real situations with real situations out there. And I think you're exactly right. There's no going back to the past, right? We just talked about that, not romanticizing the past. So I don't think we can go back to this bygone area. And I mean this too. If you think that America needs to be obviously need to be denounced, if you think America needs to be whiter or something, or you think America needs to go back to some kind of more 1950s homogenized culture, because it's just not there anymore, and it's not going to be that ever again. It's becoming obviously much more eclectic, multicultural. It's becoming,
right. Yeah, it's
but there's
diverse.
Bad parts about this too. I mean, I think the sort of postmodernism or or no meaning of anything, the secularization of America. There's all these bad components of this, but I don't know how much they're related or interrelated. I'm obviously not blaming any immigrants for this or minority. In some ways, immigrants are more religious than your obviously your white secular liberals.
Yeah, especially
Seattle
a lot of the Hispanic immigrants. They are very strong Catholics.
Many of them are evangelicals. Many of them are Catholics. So
what I go back to, because you're touching on something that I think really the way in which to encapsulate it is there is no recognition of the American creed anymore.
Right, exactly.
That's like it's not mainstreamed anymore.
Nope.
So we used to be unified by this creed where all men are created equal with inalienable rights that come from God, and we have the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, and that everybody receives equal treatment under the law. These are understandings of America that I think those before us really clung to, and we've lost sight of it. And so then that's where you see this disjointed nature. And now instead people are tribalizing and breaking along, you
Absolutely.
Know, political lines, sexual orientation lines, racial lines. And so we need to get back to that unifying component of the American creed. And I think that that's really something that that we're lacking right now.
Yeah, I'd agree with you 100%. I think that's sort of the underlying issue. I think you really diagnosed it, is there's not a unified creed. Because look, I mean, people want different things. They want different outcomes. I think the biggest problem today, when I just sort of look out at everything, obviously, and we've talked about this on the show before, is this sort of politicization of everything. Everything has to have sort of a political aims. I think part of this has to do with the secularization of our culture. People really think that all these problems are going to be solved through politics, when in fact our whole founding documents and our whole created order of this nation was that really politics in government can do some things, but most things it can't do well, and it's not going to solve all these skirmishes or problems or divisions in our country. And so, I mean, just sort of looking out at the landscape, though, it's, to me, it's very, very depressing. And I think the culture has been sort of hijacked in some ways and leading down a direction that's just leading towards despotic culture, because people are just going to continually look more to government to really solve their problems.
Right. Yeah. And it really is primarily a social and cultural thing. So anyways, we can camp on that for longer, but let's go ahead and move on, because there are a couple more things we wanted to discuss this week. And one of them is moving government agencies, whether it be federal or state, out of the capitals. And so recently there was an announcement just a few days ago from the Interior.
Yeah, the Bureau of Land Management under the Department of Interior.
Yes, that long name. So the Bureau of Land Management headquarters is going to be moved out of D.C. And so they're moving further west, and, you know, a lot of the west is covered with federal land. So it only makes sense, I'd imagine. But those on the other side of this, such as the Interior Department's first whistleblower under Trump named Joel Clement, tweeted that moving the agency's headquarters out of D.C. would marginalize the agency and budget and policy decisions.
Sounds like a swamp creature.
Yeah, it sounds like he's wanting a lobbyist to go at least stay in Washington, D.C. so they get the money. But what do you think about moving them out?
This has been a campaign issue before. I don't remember who brought it up. And I don't remember specifically Trump bringing up in the campaign, but he might have. I can't remember if it was Rick Perry or Bobby Jindal at some point, but somebody brought this up as a core component of their campaign to some degree about, we're going to move some of these federal agencies out of D.C. And I don't remember who it was. I feel like it was somebody that was a governor. And so I've obviously heard this argument before. There's been Wall Street Journal editorials about this. I think it's a good idea in the sense that so much of the wealth, Brooke, in this nation is concentrated around Northern Virginia, suburbs of Maryland. Yeah, there's been several pieces noting this about just how bad it has gotten with just the concentration of wealth. It's completely changed the state of Virginia, you know, which is once a red state. I'm not complaining about that. It's a reality. But it's changed it into a very blue state because of Northern Virginia and the pockets of people that just rush to live in Northern Virginia to be around all the industry and all the federal spending. It's a state that's benefited mightily from federal spending, almost more probably more than any other state. And so I think one of the things that will be an advantage to this is moving some of these agencies out will help them get out of the groupthink in D.C. I think that's been the argument. Yeah. That will get them into more middle America where, you know, you're actually living amongst the people you're supposed to be representing instead of just representing the sort of the D.C. conglomerate and swamp kind of thinking that has sort of ruled the federal bureaucracy for decades upon decades. So I don't see it as a bad thing. I'd be totally open to it. I think there'd be some cost saving measures in this. Obviously, some buildings would be cheaper, upkeep, salaries could probably go down just a little bit in terms of their growth. So I'm positive. Yeah. I know they've talked about this in North Carolina. I don't know if you want to address that briefly, Brooke, but it's been bannered about here in North Carolina as well.
Well, before I do that though, really quickly, I'd be curious, should we have congressmen and women do the same thing? Like, okay, travel is so much more affordable nowadays. Mm. You can, you know, work remotely. You can do Zoom chats and things like that. Mm. Wouldn't it be better if our congressional leaders also lived in their districts?
I think some of them would like that because some like going to D.C. because they're running away from something and some hate it because they have family obligations. And
yeah,
such.
I mean, I would much rather see my congressman live among me, like run into him at Walmart or something every once in a while. And so, yeah, connecting people with the people that they're supposed to be helping is essential. And so to that end, like you said, North Carolina, some of the General Assembly elected officials have also proposed moving some of our core government agencies out of Raleigh. So the DMV plans to move its headquarters and hundreds of workers to, I believe, Rocky Mount.
Yeah, depressed area of the state.
Yeah, it's always
number one
area.
In unemployment for urban area in North Carolina.
Okay. And also, not only Rocky Mount, but another one proposed is moving the Department of Health and Human Services to Granville County. So these are two areas in which I would imagine the economy can really benefit from having government workers living and purchasing among them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I don't have any problem with this. I think it's good to get government out of one concentrated area in a state. This is a big debate. You kind of mentioned, Brooke, you know, your lawmakers living amongst you. This is a big debate in state legislatures too. I mean, do you want to have a part-time or full-time legislature? I lived before in Michigan. That's a state with a full-time legislature. And so I think there's advantages and disadvantages to both. Sometimes you have a little bit more professional legislature, which can be a good thing when it comes to governing, but also can be a bad thing because, you know, power becomes concentrated more easily. And so a lot of states love keeping their part-time legislature. They don't pay as well, but it also keeps them a little more closer to the people, some people argue. So I think that it's a good idea to get these agencies outside of just one concentrated area. I think it's good for government. It's good for the people. I mean, ultimately, it's the people who should take ownership and are supposed to take ownership of their government. So I think that's a positive step for individuals who live in the state or just in getting the federal government out of just D.C. I think that would be a good thing. Every time I go up to D.C., a lot of great things about that city. There's so much fun stuff to do, and it's beautiful.
Library of Congress.
Yeah, there's just some great museums and beautiful artifacts. Vietnam Veterans Memorial is one of my favorite things. Arlington National Cemetery, definitely one of my favorite things. But I think we do need to move some of the power structures out of D.C. if we're ever going to make any progress in this nation in terms of just sort of slowing down the bureaucratic state and the way it reigns over us. So I think it's only a positive thing. I mean, people have bandied it about for generations, and I think it's a good step in a direction we want to take. So I'm all for it, Brooke.
Yeah, same here. So before we go, I know you had wanted us to touch on the Apollo 11 anniversary. So
the 50th anniversary, 1969. It's coming up. I think today or yesterday was maybe a few days ago before that was the actual launch. I don't remember what the actual date was for when they landed on the moon, but I do know this, the Chappaquiddick stuff was going on right when it happened. Ted Kennedy's famous Chappaquiddick incident, that was big in the news along with Apollo 11. But I wanted to ask you something, Brooke. Do you even think with some of the chaos going on today, it's amazing because we're dealing with 1969 technology when we landed on the moon. Do you think we could land on the moon today?
Oh, wow.
Isn't that amazing to think about?
Yeah.
In some ways, we don't accomplish great things as a nation like we did back
then.
Do you think that's true? That we've? I'm not talking about the sense of exploration. I do think we may have lost some of that.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Because we're more insular focused, right, as a nation. in some ways.
Right, which is the response to globalism, right? It's this reaction, the counter-reaction to globalism, which is why I think that we as conservatives need to stand in the middle between globalism and nationalism and find this good common ground that makes sense. But yeah, I think that's a really good question. So there was... America, I would say, by and large, was united around this sort of exploratory mission, and was there was a lot of pride in being the first that landed on the moon, and it was actually July 24th, 1969.
Okay, so it's coming up real soon.
And
Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, and of course, the first man on the moon was Neil Armstrong.
Yeah, I mean, I love that sort of just... It obviously showcases our ingenuity, our innovation, our exploration sort of...
We landed on the moon long before... anybody could dream up an iPad or an iPhone or anything.
Right, right. Yeah. So what do we have nowadays? What kind of frontiers are we looking at? And I think the tech frontier is really where where things are at, and, and we need to be a leader in that.
I hear, you know, you read some stuff, and this is good news for anybody who suffers from a chronic illness, but maybe in the coming decades or sooner, that they'll have a pill that will be like DNA. And someone who's in medicine or scientist is probably going to be thinking, this guy's an idiot. But this is kind of what I read, is that we'll be able to take medicine that will specifically treat our own conditions, our own bodies, you know? And so...
So like designer DNA
pills. Like designer DNA pills and stuff that will just treat you specifically, you know, instead of just having this medicine with all the side effects and that everybody takes, so to speak. So, you know, there's a lot of things I think to look forward to when it comes to some of our innovation, but I wonder if we've collectively lost this idea of accomplishing great things in the name of the nation because you know, just because of all the stupid infighting and tantrums and whatnot. We can't focus.
Do we reward innovation like we used to? I think that's another thing, right? So under capitalism, not cronyism, but capitalism, and there people knowing that there's going to be an amazing payout for discovering certain things, I think that's something that motivates people. And I know there's some that say, well, you should just do it out of the kindness of your heart. However, people are motivated by reward. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, like, with the disparagement, especially on the left of the wealthy, like if you listen to the last Democratic debate, they kept railing on the wealthy. And a lot of those people, I think, not all of them, but a lot of them came into wealth because they were innovative and they were really creative and entrepreneurial and took risks. And so I think that that's a component, too, that we need to look at and consider when we're thinking about this. So.
Yeah, I do want to say something because I think I neglected to say this. I hate to go for a full circle, but we were talking about Trump and some of the hypocrisy. I don't know if we covered some of the Democratic hypocrisy, but it bothers me. You know, we're talking about the immigration stuff, and I'm not letting Trump off the hook here, but then you see Beto, I know you saw this too, Brooke, in a speech where he basically says, America's a misogynistic, sexist nation based on white supremacy, and, you know, almost like kind of chiding them for coming here and not, you know, and saying, well, sorry you came here because we're this misogynistic, racist country.
Imagine telling that to people who have sold everything they own. They have uprooted their family, taken a harrowing, you know, just possibly deadly journey here, have given thousands of dollars, their entire savings, to dangerous people, all so that they can get here into the United States, and then you meet them and greet them and tell them that. Like, that is
just not American
so
to me
tone deaf.
To meet someone like that. I mean,
I'm astounded by that.
And I
want to
say that, you know, and I think that's why, and so one of the things I want to do with the Trump stuff, I'll be honest, I voted for Trump. I had a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of concerns about Trump, as a lot of people did. There are a lot of things I didn't like about him, just his demeanor, his whole, the way he uses women, the way he's spoken about women. A lot of just stuff about his Playboy lifestyle. And but I do remember some stuff, because I'm younger, I remember some stuff in the 80s he did that was good for charities, like Ryan White, the boy that had AIDS. I'm old enough to remember these things, where he reached out to the family and flew them places and did things for people. But one of the things I do is I do want to understand some of the people that do support Trump better, because I think it's easy to just denounce people all the time. And so I do think that there's this level of people that just get sick about people running America down. And so I think that's why they see the Trump tweet and they're not, they may say, I wouldn't say that, but right on, you know, in a way that get tired of people coming up and just constantly running the country down. I think what this is what's happening in this sort of 24 news hour cycle is you see these Democratic candidates, and I'm not going to just bash them because it may be that I might like one of them personally if I actually hung out with one of them. But their politics in many respects are deplorable because they're running out there. We got to have reparations. It's everything, Brooke, we've been talking about against the American creed. I mean, we got to do this. And it looks like if you're, and I want to be careful in saying this, but if you're white or you're male in this country, you really don't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. And I know there's such a thing as white privilege, and however you want to define it. But obviously there's a lot of people who had no advantage of white privilege that were white and all this stuff. But I do think that there's an element, and I'm not even saying white people are just that they take a sort of positive aspect of how things Trump's saying. You see minorities getting on Twitter praising Trump and things of that nature. So I'm not saying that, but I do think there's this element when you just see these candidates just constantly berate this country as it's sexist, it's backwards, it's misogynistic, that people want someone to fight for them. And they see, I think, the past in the Republican Party. And this is not saying Trump should be saying these things, because that's not what I'm saying. But they see the past of the Republican Party where they just kind of rolled over and played dead and said, you know what, we all just need to get along. While the Democrats continually call them racist, misogynistic, or your policies are this. And I can remember people who lived through the 90s when Newt Gingrich came to power and the Republicans in the Congress, they came to power and people compared them to Klansmen. They compared them to all this. They threw out all these names. I remember John Lewis, who's a great civil rights leader from Atlanta, who represents from Congress. I met him up in D.C., but he would get out and call Republicans Klansmen on the House floor. And they just kind of like roll over and take it, you know?
Right. There's a failure
so
of leadership.
There's this hypocrisy in many respects. And I don't want to say, you know, the stuff that Trump says out on Twitter or where else is okay or it should be said, so to speak. But I think that there's a lot of people see this guy who's kind of getting in the trenches of this cultural war and fighting back from his position that he's in and say, well, you know what? Our culture's so messed up, but this guy's out there fighting for us. So I think there's an element of that, Brooke, that sometimes we don't talk about when we just sort of blindly criticize Trump and if we just had a different president or if we just had Mitt Romney, everything would be okay. But I don't see it that way.
The problem's been festering for a long time.
Yeah.
But two wrongs don't make a right either. So
no, I agree.
I think we should be equal opportunity offenders. And really, here at Civitas, our goal is to really hold the line when it comes to conservatism, not a party.
Yeah.
And
not
that,
a president,
and
not
that,
Trumpism, not this or that.
And that means we call balls and strikes. And so what Ray is saying really is, you know, there are, you have to navigate this nuance with more wisdom, and there are things that you can actually praise that are good that have come out of this administration, and there are times and things that you should be a loud voice and say that's not okay.
Yeah.
And you should do it on both sides regardless of who is in office, because if not, you're using dishonest weights. If you're not holding people to the same standards on either side, then that's really an element of that is really just speaking into this hypocrisy that we were just railing against. And we all as humans struggle with this, but we should aspire to call balls and strikes and to be equal in how we admonish and how we praise. And so that will ruffle some feathers. It's not a popular opinion, but this is something that if you really, really care about the trajectory that we're on and the leaving America even better for our own children, then this is the backbone that you got to have. So anyways, I think we're about done.
I
Ray,
think
do
we're
you have
about
anything
done.
Else?
I mean, I don't know. It's going to be interesting in 2020, Brooke, because there's going to be a complete meltdown if Trump is reelected by a huge segment of the population. So I wonder how long we're sort of governable, you know, on this trajectory where you almost have like nullification of states just deciding to check out and whole regions of the country. I just wonder how fast, because I tend to be a little bit pessimistic about America at this moment in time. I hope that changes. But I wonder how fast we're on a trajectory to some kind of factionalism. Hopefully, I don't think it'll be anything like armed conflict or anything like the Civil War, but there's going to be some kind of factionalism ahead. And I worry about that. I hope that we can be really this e pluribus unum out of many one nation. And you know, I worry that we're so far from that. And the culture has to change to recover that. The politics can change, but the culture has to change first. I think that's the overriding principle that you and I both agree with. And so that's it.
That's it, you guys. So thank you so much for joining us this week. If you have comments on this, we know we have touched on some really emotionally charged, politically charged issues. So we welcome your feedback. Radio@nccivitas.org is our email address. Again, that's radio@nccivitas.org. And we welcome your feedback on this, your comments.
Yep.
And so thank you guys so much for listening and have a wonderful week.
Bye-bye.